You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So, well, let's do introductions first, and we're going to use titles, yeah? Because we worked out, all of us worked hard for it, yeah? So I'm Dr. Not that kind of doctor, Sharon Jagger. I'm Associate Professor in Religion. I know you find that very hard to believe, so do I. And I'm at York St. John. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Is that sarcastic? Claps. Well, oh, did you really? Oh, we've got some stuff to talk about, me and you, at the end.
Great. Hi, my name's Alex Fry, Dr. Alex Fry. I'm a senior lecturer at Bournemouth University in the Sociology of Health and Illness.
Yeah. It's not sexy as religion, though, is it? To be honest.
I am Reverend Anna Alls. I am not a doctor. And Alex and Sharon wrote to me when I agreed to do this seminar. They wrote to me and said, if you could send in your academic biography. And I was like, isn't the whole point of me being involved with this that I don't have an academic biography? So I had to bluff something. So I'm not a doctor. So if you've got questions about boils on your bum or in growing toenails, if you can direct them to Alex and Sharon.
Yeah, we'll have
And I'm just here for the theology.
Just the theology. We'll see if those rapturous applause last until the end. And we've counted everybody, so we know anybody who will leave. We know who you are. So we're going to talk about class, tricky old subject, because what is class? So just a heads up, I am going to ask you to think about how you see yourselves in the class landscape, but I'll give you some clues first of all. When Alex and I, we started a project, which is why we're here, Alex is going to tell you all about it, Working Class Clergy in the Church of England. It's seriously not as dull as it sounds. We were challenged, really. We found one anyway, found an interesting one. We were challenged about our definitions of working classness and how we were going to attract people into our project. We got 50 people in the end, 50 clergy people who said, yes, I identify as working class. But there was something going around social media saying clergy cannot be working class. And technically, if you, in the olden days, it was the Registrar General's list of occupations, and now it's the Office for National Statistics. There's got to be some of that sort of stuff in this, you know. So it's not all jokes. Some of it's sort of serious stuff. So that list of occupations identifies people. So guess where clergy are? They're pretty high up. They're the second one down from monarchy or something. Can't remember what the top one is. And funnily enough, who, sorry? There's quite a few, because there's lots of sub thingies in the new one. I promise we did look at this, but early on in the project, and we thought, no, we're not going to use that anyway, so it's not really relevant. Look it up. It's very, very interesting. In fact, it's so complicated, you can type your occupation in, and the machine will tell you what class you are, so you don't need to think about it.
So it's nothing to do with eating hummus?
No, or Chateau Neuf du Pape. But we'll come on to that.
Okay, right.
We'll come on to that. So the Office of National Statistics believe me and Alex and Anna are all very middle class. And obviously, you can't tell because I've lost my accent. but I've never identified as middle class. But my job is identified as middle class. So that's really weird. So a lot of clergy find themselves in that same strange position. Of course you can be working class. Anna's going to tell us how that can be. So you could go by occupation. You could go by what your family were like, how you were brought up. And it used to be your dad and that occupation. So anybody who's the same age as me will remember, if your dad were a joiner, that you were working class. Didn't matter what your mother did, because it was all about patriarchy. But these days, it's the main bread earner. So have a little think about that.
Thank goodness that's changed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Done away with the patriarchy.
Well, yes. Completely smashed it. Yeah. We'll do something about that next year. So you could go by occupation, you could go by your family, and a posh sociological word for that is habitus, but that might come up later on. You could go by your tastes and your hobbies, so if you like a bit of hummus and squashed avocado...
And skiing.
Then that might make you feel a certain alignment to a certain group of people. If you like egg and chips... And
ketchup.
Ketchup, aye.
Do you call it ketchup or red sauce?
Red sauce.
Red sauce. Can we have a show of hands? Show of hands for ketchup. Ooh. Show of hands for red sauce. Yeah, there are some working
cool
class people here.
Yeah. Okay, so have you got the general idea? So I'm going to give you some choices and I want you to show your hands, put your hands up for the category that you... Is anybody squirming right now? Do it for us, yeah? We won't film all the aristocracy people here. So you have, the choices are, you've got working class, middle class, you've got a mixture of both because you might have what we call mixed cultural capital. So you want to have a little bit of both. That's absolutely fine. We do have aristocracy, who knows? Greenbelt might be quite posh. We've got the revolutionaries who are totally classless and refuse to categorise themselves. You're welcome, obviously. And then I've put lumpen proletariat. You know, if you're that, you know who you are. Okay, so shall we start with the middle class category? Who would identify themselves as middle class? I'm just looking at the dudes outside. Yeah. I think that's a fair proportion, isn't it? Who would say that they were working class? Fewer, welcome comrades. Fewer, slightly fewer. Who would say it's mixed cultural capital? Yeah, that's. I mean, it's very common that these days because of social mobility and we've got rid of all the factories, so that happens. And who would say they were aristocracy? Come and talk to me in secret afterwards and I will be your new best friend. You've landed aristocracy. And who would say they were part of the lumpen proletariat? A chap at the back. Hurrah. And have I done the rejection? Who's the revolutionary? We don't do class in our house. Nobody. That's. Oh, was there somebody at the back? Ooh, a bit of an anarchist, maybe, an anarcho-syndicalist over there. That's really interesting. So most people here have some sort of idea of what class means to you. So that's super interesting. What we're going to do now, Alex is going to drag me off the stage and he's going to tell you a little bit about the actual nuts and bolts of the project that we did with working class clergy.
Because what we thought we needed to... help you to really take this project seriously was a straight white educated man. So we found one.
Oh, poor Alex. It's all right though. He's all right though.
He's really yes. Nice. As they go, he's all right.
Right,
high praise
indeed.
Alex. Right, thanks, Sharon. And just before I get into this, just a reminder that there are. Yellow scraps of paper for you to write questions on about halfway through our session. I think they'll be collected up in baskets, so please do be writing questions down as they come to you. Yes, we've given them out. But basically, my job is the slightly more boring bit before we get into the meat of things. And it's just to explain why have we done this in the first place? Why care about well-being amongst working class clergy? And the short answer is, at this point in time, the Church of England, to its credit, has realised that clergy well-being is a serious issue. Clergy well-being is particularly low. About one third of the clergy at any one point in time have depression. Burnout is a real thing. The boundaries between your personal and professional life or vocational life are obviously incredibly blurred. And Sharon's conversation with Anna is going to be teasing out some of that in more detail. But that's basically where the Church of England is at. And so the Living Ministry project is this longitudinal study that's been conducted by the National Ministry Team into clergy wellbeing. And it's following clergy from their ordination onwards over a period of about 10 years plus, I think. So it's quite a serious study. But alongside that, they are recognising that there are certain groups within the clergy who are especially predisposed to having kind of threatened or reduced well-being. And that's really about the dominant culture of the Church of England, which is much more a kind of upper middle class elitist historically, and that has implications for the dominant culture today. And so one of those groups are working class clergy. And so Sharon and I were given a pot of money and basically said, go away and help us understand how working class clergy are kind of finding their ministries. So that's what we tried to do. As Sharon said, we actually had a lot of interest. So I think we'd promised, how many people did we say we'd talk to? 20?
In our bid, we said, oh, we'll definitely talk to 20 people.
Yeah. And there was a sort of Twitter storm of loads of people wanting to talk to us. So in the end, we went for about 50. And it represented working class clergy from across England, different dioceses, different roles. You got your parish priests, you got your self-supporting ministers, those in senior roles, those who are retired, those who are supposed to be retired but still doing more or less full-time free labour, those in diocesan roles and so on. So we had quite a breadth. And I think we had slightly more women than men, but I don't think there was that much in it, was there really? It was almost 50-50.
Surprisingly balanced, actually. We didn't fiddle with the cohort at all, if you see what I mean. We definitely didn't do that. But we didn't... Anyway, Alex, over to you.
Right, thanks. And what we aimed to do was really to amplify the experiences of those 50 clergy. So obviously there is some kind of academic analysis that we've been doing, but the long and short of it is to amplify those voices. And so we ended up, after we wrote the draft of our report, which we'll be talking about in a bit, we came up with a list of draft recommendations for the Church of England. And then we did focus groups with half of our initial participants. So we interviewed 50, 25 of those were then in focus groups, and they helped us to hone and refine those recommendations and just help make sure that what we were reporting was an accurate reflection of their lived experience. So we kind of had a relatively easy job, I would say, all told. All we're doing really is explaining what people have said to us. In a nutshell, that's all we've aimed to do. And so we published the report, I think it was October of last year, called Let Justice Roll Down Like Waters, which is obviously a biblical quote from the Minor Prophets. And the reason we chose it is because we knew the Church of England is a highly politicised institution, and class is a highly politicised matter. And we knew that in 2018, Justin Welby had given an address to the Trade Union Congress on that verse. And he spent about an hour talking about it. So we thought, great, if that's what we call it, he's got to take it seriously. And so that's what we did. And we were pleasantly surprised, weren't we? Even kind of almost overwhelmed at the traction it had in the press. I mean, it was even on kind of BBC Radio 4. It was on, you know, been picked up by The Guardian, The Times and so on. And we really weren't expecting that.
And I think it shows there's a zeitgeist that people are interested in social class, particularly if you identify as working class. And suddenly it's OK to kind of talk about the systemic barriers and actually the kind of heartfelt stories that were told to us, people were saying, oh, thank goodness there's a kind of space for me to talk about this. And then when they got into the focus groups, it was amazing to see folks saying, being affirmed, really, everybody having very similar experiences, and probably the first time for a lot of them having voiced these out loud. So that, again, like you said, Alex, that made our job super easy because people were being their own sociologists in that research process.
Absolutely. And thankfully, in I think it was the February General Synod, so the church's governing body, they committed to addressing class inequality. And there are some issues that Sharon in particular picked up on in that discourse, which we will probably kind of pick up and do some work on moving forward. But we were very encouraged that the motion that was put to the Church of England Synod was, amongst other things, to seek to address the recommendations in this report. And like I said, those recommendations really came out of that engagement with our 50 and then 25 participants. So what we're really hoping is the change that is just around the corner, although I'm sure it won't be an easy process of change, but nevertheless, those changes will be earthed in the lived experiences of working class clergy. So that's really what this is all about. And just one more thing from me before I... Two more things, actually. Sorry, that's a lie. Two more things before I hand over. The first is that if anyone wants to continue the conversation, the Sarum College have a stand quite near where the CMS stand is and SCM and where the watch stand is, down that kind of alley of stalls. And I'll be there between midday and 1 o'clock tomorrow. And they're very happy to host those further dialogues. And I think maybe Anna's going to be there as well. So if you want to pick up the conversation, you're very free to. Other than that, I'm just going to hand over, and hopefully in about 15 minutes' time, there'll be baskets going round. Please do pop some questions in there, and then I'll just be to the side sifting through them, deciding perhaps which are the most common questions, and we'll use that for our Q&A towards the end.
So but getting rid of all the hard ones.
Getting rid of all the hard ones.
Excellent, that's what we like.
Over to you.
And just to mention as well, Anna and Luke Lana, who's been around, who some of you may have already come across, both did podcasts as springboarding off the project. So on the same Living Ministry page as the report, you'll be able to find podcasts with Anna and Kate Botley, which is a very serious, deep theological discussion with some jokes thrown in. That's but brilliant storytelling in that. And then Luke has a podcast with Alex as well. Luke were really appreciative of Luke because he, right from the word go, said, you know what, this is a social justice issue. And our the first tranche of interviewees said, I'm only getting involved in this on the understanding that you're not asking working class people to change, but you are orienting the discussion towards the institution. So it's about systemic change, not about how much Shabley can you drink in a week in order to belong. So we absolutely took that up, and we obviously come from that perspective anyway. So it's about social justice and about systemic and cultural change, not about working class people working on themselves to fit in, which is a slightly different orientation probably than the original brief, if I can be so bold as to say that. So, Anna.
Hello.
Am I allowed to say that you were one of the interviewees, or is that confidential?
I think we should task people to go away and read the report and see if they can find my anonymised quotes.
So completely anonymised, Anna. we talk about this in the I'm just being flippant, obviously. Talking about this in the podcast, so not breaking any confidences.
Nope.
That haven't already been completely smashed.
I'll just deny it all.
Yeah, and if you'll I'm get pushed. Away with it. That's absolutely fine. So we're just going to have a quick Q&A with Anna to draw out her story and the things that matter to her as a self-identified working class clergy person.
I think that's the funniest statement, a self-identifying working class person.
Okay, go on then. go on then. How do you define class and yourself in that?
Okay, so I think I'm working class because I grew up in a pit village in a mining community in North Notts. My family are all around. They all still live in that same village. I am a great disappointment to my family because I've moved 15 miles away. And that is, I am the girl as well. So the girl has moved away, left her family. My brothers still live really close to my parents. My dad worked in a factory and my mum did bits of jobs, you know, like kept the world going. Dinner lady, receptionist, loads of volunteering with various things. She worked in a leisure centre, teaching people who dropped out of school how to read and write. But bits of jobs, you know what I mean by that, don't you? Nothing that anyone ever takes seriously. So I still have my regional accent and I finished school at the age of 16 when I did my GCSEs. I've got 4 GCSEs, didn't pass RE, but I think that's standard for clergy, isn't it? I did pass a module in RE, actually, the Muslim module, the module on Islam. I did got 25 out of 25 on that one. When I went to theological college when I was 30 and I had 2 children, oh yeah, of course, because that's another thing that defines class. I had my children at 23 and 26, because if you're going to do it, just get it out of the way. And in my maternity class in Sutton in Ashfield, where I grew up, I was the oldest and the only married mother. I was 23 when I had my first baby. The oldest and the only married mother. When I went to theological college when I was 30 and I was asked, we were all in this room together. I had a massive chip on my shoulder already because I was 30. So that's quite young to be a woman at theological college. And I already knew that I was odd. And they said to us, undergrads, you're in the library, postgrad, you stay where you are. I don't know what I was. And I had to say to the tutor, Ben Fulford, anyone know Ben Fulford? It was. And I went to him and I said, I don't know what I am. And and he looked at me like I was a turnip. I don't know what I am. What do you mean I don't know what I am? I don't know what I am. That thing that you just said, I don't know what I am. I don't know what room I need to go to, because I'd not been to university. I didn't know what postgrad meant or what undergrad meant. I didn't know what that meant. A bit chippy because I often feel like I'm the odd one out. I don't speak the language. I don't have the some of the experiences that other people have had. And so sometimes chippy, but sometimes, honestly, I just feel really smug because there's a lot. We're not being recorded, are we? We are being recorded. Yeah, don't say that then.
Tell us that afterwards.
Whisper, if you want to know what I was going to say, ask me. Ask me later. About 1 a.m. I'll be in the glitter ball disco. I'll speak freely.
Can I just ask you about accent then? Because that came up a lot with our cohort. Some folks felt that they had to change their accent to smooth it out in order to belong and fit in and get a job in the church. And others held on to their accent because it's part of identity. And I've felt these same pressures. So have you had experiences of that?
Yeah, we did. When I was at theological college, we had to record ourselves preaching and watch it back. So if we've got clergy here, right, there are other clergy who've had to do this. Put your hand up if you've had to watch yourself preach a sermon. Yeah, it's horrific, isn't it? So I heard myself preaching and I remember doing the warm up to the sermon, you know, the joke at the beginning. And I did it in like a broad North Notts accent. I was dead funny. And I can even remember what it was. It was a joke about my granddad always being prepared and having a carrier bag in his pocket. And a proper Sutton accent. And then, of course, I had to go on and do some theology. So I had to use my theology voice for that. Because I was being recorded and needed to be taken seriously. And I heard myself. So that would have been in the first or second year at college. And I heard my voice and my accent and the way I pitched myself kind of change in the way that I was doing the warm-up and then the actual body of the sermon. I wasn't dead keen on what I heard. And I wondered why I did it. It made me reflect on what I was doing and why it mattered. Why did the theology need to be done in a proper voice? And the jokes, the warm-up could be done in what was more representative of who I am. Did that answer the question? I can't remember what you asked
No,
me.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's certainly a theme coming out in the report about people's consciousness about how they sound and whether you sound thick because you've got a northern accent or a regional accent.
That's definitely a thing. And people will pull me up on things. So I might say, weren't it, instead of wasn't it? Because that's just how we say things in North Notts. And me and my friend instead of my friend and I. My friend and I sounds really pretentious to me. I don't think I have ever used that in a sentence, ever. But me and my friend, we often do things. I remember writing an email. So if you're from Nottingham, or you will have heard of Home Pierpont, I had the custodian of the Pierpont estate in one of my congregations. He was a character. And I wrote him an email once, and he wrote back, and he'd corrected the grammar in my email. The rude Yeah.
And so let's just talk about the situation of the Church of England, because probably anybody in sort of society who is working class will absolutely identify with what you just said. What is it particularly about the Church of England as a clergy person that has got right on your nerves about its middle classness, shall we say?
I think just the expectation that we can all speak this language. And I don't think you know until you get there, because you go to your local church, don't you? And your local church is representative of the people in your local community. So that feels safe. That feels homely. There's people around you who speak like you, who communicate like you do. And then you go to theological college and you realise that the church... It was only at that point that I realised that the church is not made up of people like me. I used to be an evangelical and was part of New Wine. I can remember sitting in conferences at New Wine and watching the couples on the stage, you know, the man, the vicar, and his lovely wife, doing their things and wondering why I wasn't up there doing the same thing. Well, I know now. Because I don't speak that language. You don't know what you don't know until you get there, and it's odd. And you can't necessarily work out what's odd. You know, there's always that feeling of being slightly unsettled and not quite fitting in. I think clergy often feel like that regardless, and we probably should do. We are a bit odd, and we probably should not quite fit in. That's probably the role. But I think for working class clergy, we've come from a completely different background and lifestyle.
And if you dip into the report, you'll see a lot of that revolves around just mundane things like money, holidays, hobbies.
The way we communicate is huge. So I've always, until my most recent post, I've always ministered in working class communities. So you go out the front door. Well, firstly, the vicarage is the biggest house in the village, or I've been in pit villages on a housing estate. So you go out your house is the biggest. It's really easy to get people into church and events that you're doing. You put food on and they'll turn up, or you tell them that children can come, and they come along. And you say, and there's no airs and graces. You go out your house. I've got dogs, so I walk my dogs and I bump into people and I say, "Morning, Kevin, how are you?" And Kevin says, "Oh, I'm not great, actually." Or words to that effect. Where I live now, I'm in the suburbs of Nottingham City, and I go out my house and people say, "Good morning, Vicar." And the vicarage is definitely not the biggest house in the village. And I can tell you that I reckon I'm probably the poorest person who lives there. And we have this complete mismatch in communication, because if you ask me a question, I will answer the question. I can answer it really quickly and I will tell you the truth. And they don't communicate like that in the village that I live in. They, you say to them, we should do this thing. Why don't we do this thing? I've had an idea. Why don't we try this thing? And they go, yeah, that's a great idea, Vicar. We'll definitely try that thing. And then they don't do the thing. And you go back eventually and you go, why didn't we do that thing that we were going to do? And they go, well, we decided not to do the thing, actually. And you think, well, why didn't anyone tell me that we weren't doing the thing? Because I'm the vicar and I'm in charge. But they just decided that that it just wasn't a good idea or something. But they didn't communicate with me about it, because why would you have to? The other thing that they do, they want me to write things down all the time. If you could write a report on that and bring it to PCC, no. No. I'm not sitting and writing a report and bringing it to PCC. I can tell you what I think. I'll tell you about it at PCC. I'll host a public meeting. I can tell you what I think. I don't need to write a report. That drives me mad. Writing a report. Who's got time for that? I could sit at home all day writing reports and then I'd be an academic.
Exactly. Yeah. Come and join
then
us.
Then I'd have an academic biography.
Yeah, come and join the dark side. It's a lot better. So there are these cultural things that we're talking about that are deeply embedded, and I feel like we've kind of been a bit mean. A little bit, haven't we? And
is it mean or is it funny?
It's funny. But there's lots of our participants were saying, look, people are lovely and we love our congregations, but it's the systemic stuff and it's the cultural stuff that folks are not aware of. So when one person said they're absolutely brassic, skint, because they're a vicar on a not very good stipend, and the Unison are going to go sort that out, follow that story. But instead of getting rewarded for doing something over and above in cash or something useful, like a flan. I meant pie. Sorry.
Working class.
I've been in academia far too long. You know, they get a kind of, I don't know, a bottle of wine that probably is not part of a person's... I love wine, can I just say? It's a bad example because I can drink buckets of the stuff.
I don't really drink.
Do you not?
I don't really
drink. So a bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape would be wasted on you.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. Give me 20 quid. And it's and I'll give it to the church because we're not allowed to receive gifts like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So basically the tenor of the report... points us to these systemic cultural things that people aren't aware of. And you talked about theological college and the expectation that people will have already gone to university and this sort of lack of understanding of the value of other ways of life. So one person we interviewed used to be a bus driver, and that feeling that, well, that doesn't count because it was a working class job. So there are those sort of issues.
I can assure you, I worked in retail before I was ordained, and I learnt far more useful things working in retail with actual real people than I did in... Well, I learnt loads of useful stuff in theological college, but the two things combined, real life experience of working with human beings and managing people, is absolutely valid. And I think there's a lot of clergy who maybe haven't had that experience of working with people in that way, and members of the public as well. Clergy work with the public. It's part of the gig.
Can we just touch on the discourse? This is a bit of a thing that we're certainly hoping to expand on. So there's an article done by somebody who worked with us from Durham University, and she wrote an article looking at the ways of speaking in synod about estate mission, estate ministry. So if you're at all in touch with the Church of England, you'll know estate ministry is a thing. We could talk all day about the ins and outs of that, but she looked at how that was expressed in terms of language in synod and pulled some very interesting quotes out. And I hope I hope this isn't anybody in this room who said it, because that would be a bit embarrassing. But for example, one person saying, oh, our youth work was really successful in such and such an estate. You know, some of those kids hadn't eaten at a dining table until they'd come and had contact with us.
And that's the measure. Wow.
I mean, if you eat at dining tables, you've
got
thinking,
a dining room. You've got a
what's
big
your
enough
knee
house.
For? That's what your knee is for. And how can you watch telly if you're sat at the dining room?
I've got a dining room, but I've also got two adult children. Where do we put all their stuff?
Exactly.
If it's not on the dining room table.
Exactly. Where's your ironing going to go if you're eating off the table? Anyway, the point being, there's this unconscious sense of middle-class mores being conflated with Christian outreach and Christian behaviour. I used to be a youth worker and I came across it. So the young people from the estate where the church was all smoked. That's what they did. They lined up outside. They all smoked. So that's where I went and chatted to them. The measure of their spiritual journey was, do they smoke? Do they swear? Can they sit through a service? And you know, can we just sort of clean these people up a bit? And even at a very young age that I was then, I thought something kind of, you're conflating what being a Christian's about and what being a clean cut middle class with good those types of manners, you know, however you want to frame that, and that conflation seeps into the hierarchy and into sort of synod discussions. I think personally, it's a massive problem.
I think before we even get into synod, we need to pay attention. We need to look at the kind of people who are representing us on synod, and the kind of backgrounds that they have. And even among clergy, I think we're less people who are not part of the mainstream Church of England. That's what we're talking about. Don't necessarily feel able to volunteer for those kinds of roles. So we're not represented in the hierarchy or the decision-making bodies because we don't have a seat at the table. And actually, the table's really boring. And it's not where our gifts lie. So we're not even represented before we even get to synod, before our stories are even heard. They're not heard, are they? Because it's someone who met a poor person once, who's going to tell a story about what happened.
There is, just to have a shout out to Bishop Lynn Cullens, who's sort of taken the report. She has a working class background and she's beavering away in the background. We probably don't even know quite how that is spreading around people. So there are one or two well-placed people, but as you say, it's kind of a thing, isn't it? So that Lynn Cullens feels that that's her mission now, almost, to kind of speak into these kind of hierarchical situations. Just a final question, and you kind of touched on this. What are the main things you would want then the church to do to make? Can you just do this in like 10 seconds to make life better for working class clergy, or to change the church somehow so it wasn't so elitist? Do you think the church is elitist in that way?
Yeah, the church is elitist. Yeah, because there's a whole thing around education and background and stuff still. So we have to go right back to the beginning, I think, and how are we selecting people and what's on offer? I'm in the middle of getting divorced and I'm skint. And I've got to apply for grants to pay for stuff. I don't earn enough money to get divorced. I stayed married for as long as I did because I wasn't in a position where I could imagine being able to get divorced, the divvying up of finances and stuff. So that's huge for me, actually. Pension. My pension's rubbish. And now I've got half a house in Sutton in Ashfield. So half a house in Sutton in Ashfield is not worth very much at all. That doesn't translate to a house that somewhere that I can live when I retire in a nice, affluent part of the world, in a cathedral town, or even in Nottingham City where I live now. So I think there's a lot of stuff about not just how we get people into theological college. We can do that. We can get people into theological college, but we need to earn enough money to actually live. Do you know what? It's awful having to apply for grants to pay for an MOT for your car. It's gross. It's insulting. Your pride and your sense of worth is horrific. It's just awful. So there's that. And then that kind of impending doom that hangs over you when you think, well, I'm 45 now. I've not got a husband who's working. Where am I going to live? What decisions am I going to make? How long am I going to have to minister for? What is my pension going to be worth? And then, you know, the state of the world, it might not even matter. But but what's my future? Is a question that it just, it's scary. It feels scary. It feels intimidating and anxiety inducing when I think about what my future might be. I'm going to be living in an almshouse or with my brother in Kirkby in Ashfield.
Oh, it's a bit worse than death. Sorry, I don't know your brother. I'm sure he's lovely.
It's fine. He drives lorries. He's fine. He'll also be working as long as I am.
Well, just to give you a bit of context about that, the church's labour is built on the assumption that people have got houses that they've already bought. And are renting them out. So clergy are encouraged to be good landlords. A lot of clergy don't want to, they're socialists. They don't want to be renter, you know, rentier.
Evil landlord.
You know, it's that kind of expectation that you come already having material stuff behind you. So if your family have been lifelong renters, you don't have a house to cash in on. You've got no inheritance, to be blunt, and you've not bought your own house. So that retirement scenario is real for a lot of working class clergy.
And then you move into a vicarage and it's huge. You've got massive bills to pay and you have to try and furnish this thing. And then you move again in 5 years' time and you've got to try and furnish and carpet and put curtains up. Has anyone bought curtains recently? For a vicarage proportion, some of you have. It's just not feasible. If you've got someone in your family who lives in a stately home, then maybe they've got a couch or a dining room table or even a curtain in the airing cupboard that you can cobble something together. But certainly in my family, there was nothing like that. We're pulling stuff together. We've got bits of voile from Wilko's.
Wrong with Wilko's. We've got about 20 minutes-ish. So hopefully folks have got questions. Absolutely do feel free to ask Anna about all intimacies of her life that she hasn't already revealed. But if you... she'll answer, it'll be fine. But if you want to ask about the report, then Alex will do that bit. Or if you've got a story that you want to share, it doesn't actually have to be a question. If you want to pitch into the conversation, that would be brilliant.
We also have a roaming mic available as well, so perhaps maybe get one or two questions from there as the baskets are being collected up.
And just while we have that hiatus, the blue glossy postcard, what I designed from Vistaprint, has a QR code, so that does work. It sends you straight to the report. We're all teched up. So keep that postcard. Alex and I's email addresses, did you like that, Alex and I? Uh-huh. Email addresses are on there. Absolutely email us with any follow-up comments, complaints to Alex.
yeah, definitely to them too, not
to
me.
The nice things to me, please. Or if you want to say, what else are you doing? Put me on a mailing list, anything like that. Absolutely, please do email us and we'll keep the conversation going if it's relevant to you. Hopefully it is.
And the pencils, they're mine and I'm quite poor.
If you could add to the pencil pile, that would be much appreciated. Right, Alex, you, I'm going to hand over to you to conduct the question.
Great, okay. Well, I think we have our first question in the corner over there.
Thanks for that. I'll just, for the folks outside, so the stories. Hi, Stella. If you didn't quite catch that, so there's a story about Justin Welby going into a church and saying, pointing out that there's a big difference between church going, which is a nice thing to do with your Sunday mornings and your kids get looked after, and being a Christian, and it's that sense of conflation. Have I paraphrased that okay? Oh, sorry. Well, you know, well, I thought I'd add a little bit there for you. Thank you for the point.
Well, we have a couple of questions to start. Well, we actually have a lot of questions, but how about a couple just to start us off, which are quite thought-provoking and which I think lots can be said, so we'll probably need to keep it fairly concise. But someone said, is there a difference between northern and southern middle and working classness? And they've asked, did we have any southern working class clergy in the report?
Yes, excellent question. There is a thing, isn't there? And it's been in the news with GCSEs. There is a regional divide. And we often do make assumptions about northernness and people in the south. No, we had working class clergy from across England, from probably every region, most regions. But northernness has a special piquancé, doesn't it?
It's another chip, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a book. Ellie Watt and Nigel Rooms wrote a book about the Northern Gospel. So taking a slightly different angle, they looked at churches in the north. Obviously, it overlaps onto class, but they were very interested in northernness as a kind of ethnicity almost, and how churches kind of were northern in their cultural outlook. Beginnings of research there and understanding. I think there's more that could be talked about that. So, there's definitely a conversation to be had about the differences between northern identity, southern working class identities, but we didn't draw distinctions in that way. We everybody's skint. Lots of people were annoyed about their jobs, their manual jobs being sort of ignored and that sort of thing. So there were the commonalities, really. But really interesting question that.
Well, I'm just grouping them because there's quite a few overlapping questions. But this next question, I said to you, Sharon, I'd keep them easy. I lied. So I think this is a very important question actually for us to answer. But the question of intersectionality. Now, obviously, we've had a bit of the intersectionality between class and gender today. But a number of people have asked about those from global majority heritage backgrounds, where they featured in our report. How would you respond to that?
100%. Which term?
Global majority heritage. I think so.
Intersectionality.
Intersectionality it's an academic term. Forgive us, but it means you might be a woman who is of colour, who is working class, who is disabled, and those are multiple barriers, social barriers that create bigger problems than their individuality, if you see what I mean. And often we just talk about gender or race or disability and forget to put those together when people are faced with multiple barriers. Does that make sense? Thank you for pointing that out. Global majority heritage is the term that is now used to talk about people of colour and basically, our cohort was 100% white, and we do say that in the report. It's a weakness. There lots of reasons probably for that, but there is a separate report written by Selena Stone in the same series, and she focuses on people of colour, but doesn't talk about class So we recognise there's a kind of work to be done, which we are going to do, actually. We've got a book that's on its way that pulls those things together to try and break down those siloed conversations that go on. So as a woman and a working class woman, do you recognise that mix of identities as a clergy person?
Yes, for sure. So being youngish when I was ordained, being female and being working class, people have an expectation of what I can do, what I can deliver, what I ought to be involved with. When I turned up in the parish that I'm in now, they were thrilled when I turned up because they thought that that meant they continued to run the church the way they wanted to run the church. And they hadn't given enough credit to what a working class woman could do. I'd fought really hard to get where I was. I still had some fight in me. That's how it is.
And if you listen to their podcast, some of that does come out, the gender angle. And again, we'll plug our future book. If you look out for it, we will be talking about that. There was a gentleman in the yellow. Did you have your hand up for a question?
Yeah, it was a comment on what you said Northernness and southernness. Most of my working life has actually been in theological education, one in a college in the north and the other in the south, and I did notice differences. So the college in the south, the majority of people were from the south, particularly the southeast, and I would say were 90% middle class. The college in the north, there was a much more of a social mix. Greater number of working class candidates, and there was a sense there that they went to their local college. They sort of owned it in a sort of regional sense. And I would say also with regard to accent that many of the middle class ordinands retained quite a strong northern accent. So I think, I don't know if that chimes in with your experiences, but that's what I found over a long period. Yeah.
Very interesting. We are doing some work with theological colleges coming out of the report. So that is, in fact, it'd be brilliant if you could email us and we'll have a little conversation about that, because that sounds incredibly useful. But obviously we're talking in generalities, and do dip into the report where some of these stories kind of drill down into that sort of thing, particularly about accent. Yeah.
Great. And this next question fits quite well with Annie's last comment. I want to preface this by saying that actually a lot of the work that we're aiming at doing is about creating structural change, as Sharon mentioned earlier. And there are lots of questions to that, which I will choose one of those to read out in just a moment. But there is a question here about well-being at the individual level. How do you survive in the face of snobbery and prejudice? What helps you to be resilient?
Well, that is a good question. The church, you have to put your own support networks around you. So you can operate entirely as an individual and disconnected from everything that's around you. Clergy have quite a lot of power and they have a lot of independence, and you can choose what you want to connect into and what you need to connect into. I need people around me for sure. So I've got lots of friends and lots of support around me. I've got a good family as well. But I think you need to engage with some of that stuff. But also, this is one of the things that's come out, like the way we let off steam, the kind of things that we enjoy doing. I'm not going skiing in France in February half term. That's not going to happen. Do you ski in France in February half term? I don't know. But if you do, I'm not going. But I do like going out and going nightclubbing and dancing with my friends. And I work out because that's quite cheap to be able to do that. So that's another way of being physically well. But that's a bit of a thing in the church as well, like a vicar who works out, who's fit, who takes care of a body and things like that. That's also a bit odd. So there's some other stuff going off there, isn't there? So I think you can get, you need to put the right support around you. Nobody's going to do that for you, ultimately. And I would say that to anyone at any level, with any background and any at any level in the church. You need to put your own support network in place because nobody's going to do that for you.
Now, like I said, the number of questions were about the kind of so what? What do we do with this? And I thought this question was articulated in I think, quite a pointed way, but I think it's worth expressing it, which is, how are the recommendations going to be implemented when the strategic direction is managed and facilitated by those who don't know what it is to be working class, but live a life of the upper class? Will it be a mix of all, and this is in inverted commas, classes? Now, it's probably also just kind of briefly mentioning some of the types of recommendations we made as well before answering that.
And just to reiterate, Bishop Lynn Cullen's could have written that question, absolutely recognises her job in the hierarchy is to be that voice and to forge ahead with this. So we organise the recommendations to, some of them are pointed towards the hierarchy, some of them are pointed towards theological educational establishment, so at that level, you know, what are your cultural barriers, and some of them are about finances, so they're very practical. So we have a set of recommendations that are about the church needs to really look at retirement, which, as Anna said, massive issue for people who don't have family wealth behind them and don't own a house that they can live in. So a lot of the recommendations are at that practical level. We also talk about union, clergy joining unison and understanding that there's a kind of collective thing going on there, and for the first, it's unprecedented, but unison have submitted a pay claim to the Church of England. I don't quite know what's happening with that, but that's happening. So one of our recommendations was clergy become active themselves in sort of union activity.
I think we did get a pay rise. We had. So when I was first ordained, I earned 25 grand a year, and I've been ordained for over 12 years. And until last year, I earned 26 grand a year. That was what I bought home. I bought 26 grand home in 2023. And when I was first ordained, I think I bought 24 grand home. But we've had a pay rise in April. It's going to be 26 and a half this year.
That is really interesting.
No, it's a significant pay rise.
Yeah, and what is interesting about that process is that there's a union involved for the first time ever, as far as I know.
It was definitely.
I mean, that is really interesting. So basically, in answer to that question, some of the recommendations are focused on what the hierarchy can and should do and talk about. Some of them, working class clergy have got agency, so it's supporting working class clergy to agitate and to, you know, speak up and to call out classism, basically.
There's no such thing as the voiceless.
No.
There's only people who are not listened to. We do have a voice, and largely it's really loud.
There were some quiet people in our cohort, just to... don't want to stereotype working class people.
Great. So, well, we have just 1 minute left. Now, a lot of these questions are about details in the report, and I think probably the best thing to say is Sharon has bought and I think handed out these blue postcards, which have a link to the report in them. It's freely available online on the Living Ministry website. If you just Google Living Ministry Church of England, you'll find it. We had hoped to have physical copies available, but I'm afraid the church didn't send them out to us in time. So we don't have them for you to take away today. I'm sorry about that. We did try. But other than that, I think we have time for just one more question that I would like to read. And it's this. What is your favourite biscuit?
Am I answering that?
We'll all answer it.
Okay. Really bad luck, actually, for me, because I've got celiac disease as well, on top of everything else. Which means I'm allergic to gluten, which means biscuits are just not a thing for me, really. I know, it's really sad, isn't it?
What do you dunk in your tea?
My favourite snack.
Remember how we began by saying clergy and never working class anymore? I'm about to give it away. My favourite little treat, it's cashew nuts covered in chocolate from M&S.
Made by rare bulls. And mine's bourbon biscuits, because you can dunk them in your tea. They're fab, aren't they? Biscuit.
Well, I'm also gluten-free, but what I will say is Morrison's has an excellent selection of gluten-free biscuits. But I would have to say I would probably also choose the bourbon.
Yeah, yes. Any other biscuits? Shout them out. Custard creams. Jaffa cakes, yes. Hobnobs. They're solid, aren't they?
I'd have chosen a hobnob.
Ginger nuts, absolutely. Sorry, there's a joke going through my head that I'm not going to say. Shall we just give Anna a round of applause? Thank you, Anna.
A round of applause for being working class.
For being working class, but doing it with such elan. And you may want to clap the academics.
We may want to.
Only if you want to. Yeah. Just before you go, sorry that you're going to kill us out. We nicked 5 minutes at the beginning as well, didn't we? We've got just plain postcards. If you've any feedback for us, that'd be great. Maybe something like one thing that I didn't realise that I've realised would be brilliant. One thing that I'm going to go and agitate about would be brilliant. And if you've got anything that you want to agitate back to us, do you know what I mean? If you want to push back on anything that we've said, we'd absolutely welcome that. So just scribble anything like that on those blank postcards and stick them in a basket that will magically appear somewhere, or give them to us. So any feedback like that, we would really, really welcome. And an email address if you want to keep in touch and just find out what else we're doing.
And there's plenty up at the front as well of blank postcards.
Thank you. Thanks for coming and staying. That's amazing. That's a miracle in itself, isn't it? People have stayed.
I don't want any feedback about how chippy that working class vicar was, because I already know that. Yeah. Yes. I don't need you to tell me.
Thanks very much, folks. Enjoy the rest of your evening, won't you?
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.